Hello and welcome to the Chicago-Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. Today we're celebrating 30 years of the Chicago-Hamburg sister-city relationship by telling the story of Walter Heinzen, who immigrated from Hamburg to Chicago in 1923. My guest today is Walter Heinzen's grandson, John Heinzen. John was born and raised in Chicago, and he is now a filmmaker and producer in Los Angeles, where he runs the production company Bunnygraph Entertainment. So John, here we are celebrating the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, and you have a really special relationship with both Chicago and Hamburg through your grandfather. So why don't we just start by learning a little bit more about your story and the story of your grandfather?
Yes, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here today and be a part of the celebration of the 30 years of Chicago and Hamburg being sister cities. So my grandpa was born in the city of Pottensen, which is outside of Hamburg. It's today known as Pottensen-Winsen, which is the closer town. A bunch of the villages were brought together. And that's not too far from Lüneburg. So that's where he is from. And he was the last of seven children who were all born in the house. The house is still there today and owned by the family. His father had died when he was 10 years old. And he was much younger than his siblings. His oldest sibling that had already moved out of the house lived in the town of Sika, which is outside of Bremen. And so he spent a lot of time with his brother, who was a photographer. My grandfather only had a sixth grade education. They had a one-room schoolhouse in Pottensen. It's a very, very small town. The town was very involved with the local church, which I believe is a UNESCO site today, and was a very important site in the Protestant Reformation. And so my grandfather would always tell me wonderful stories of playing in the forests and the different animals they had. And he raised rabbits and birds that he could teach to talk. And it was just a really adventurous kind of Tom Sawyer with the German perspective childhood, as he would describe it to me. So when World War I started in 1914, his two middle brothers went to fight in the conflict. And so in the last 18 months of World War I, he was drafted into the German army at the age of 16. So at this point, he had been an apprentice to his older brother for several years as a photographer. And so that actually set his path and a very unique opportunity to become an aerial observer in the German army. So what he did was he was assigned to an artillery unit, and he would fly in the biplanes, and they would hang out the side of the airplanes, and they would photograph the trenches. And from that, they would then print them and scale them, which is how the artillery would know how to send the barrages in advance of a land attack, because they would want to disrupt the supply trenches for the troops on the front line. So this was a very, very dangerous job. One of the reasons why airplanes started shooting each other was because they did not want the film to get back to the ground. So what would happen is the biplanes would fly with the cameras, and then you'd have the fighter planes all around it. And then once the enemy fighter planes came, the German planes would engage the British, and then the photography planes would break off and get back to base. So this was the job that he had. And so he was stationed in France and Belgium. He was stationed at what is now a very famous aerodrome called Boisternecourt. And Boisternecourt there's a chateau there. That's usually how they did it. They had a chateau for the pilots, and if they had good level ground, that's where they would create these aerodromes. And many often the aerodromes would move around quite a bit, but this one in particular was very stable because it was outside of the town of Cambrai, which was a major German city, a major German-held French city behind the lines of the Western Front. So this would be April of 1917 through the end of the war. And so what was interesting about his experience was that he was able to be a witness to a whole bunch of history. And so when I was a little kid, we had his photographs that he showed me. My grandfather passed away when I was 13. And so I knew about some of the stories of these photographs. And there were pictures in his archive of Manfred Richthofen, who would occasionally come and visit this aerodrome that he was stationed at, and other things like that. So that's really interesting. Actually, the aerodrome that he was stationed at is known to young people today because it is actually featured in many of the World War I video games. You can actually land at this airfield in these video games today. And I've been to many of these sites, and it looks exactly like the video game and exactly like in my grandpa's pictures and exactly like it was in 1917. So really, really interesting stuff. And then my grandfather would tell stories about how when Richthofen died, you know, he had been shot down behind the lines and the British had come. They had given him a very proper burial, and then they had flown over the German aerodromes and they dropped pictures of the grave with flowers to show that they had given him a hero's burial. And I have one of those original pictures that was dropped on the airfield that he was stationed at.
Wow.
And so after the war, he was in Belgium. So he had, when they had started condensing things as the war was ending, he was actually sent to a frontline unit, and he was on a three-man machine gun crew, which for him was really kind of the source of his PTSD in his war experience. I just said it was horrible, just the death and whatnot. And then when the war ended, they just packed up their stuff and marched home. That's how it was for many, many of the German soldiers after November 11th, 1918. And so after the war, he went to art school. He went to art school in Bremen and Hamburg, where he thrived. He enjoyed it very much. And I have pictures of him in very dapper clothing. I'm sure he really, you know, there's a lot of depression at that time, but he had that very dapper clothing and was living that very early arts movement, the Beaux-Arts and Bauhaus and all those wonderful things that were happening in Germany at the time and in Hamburg. And he had family in Hamburg. His mother, whose maiden name was Quast, had a large family, and apparently Quast is a big family in Hamburg. So he had many relatives there, and so he had a lot of support. And that's where he was until April of 1923. And the incident that brought him to America was actually a very tragic one. And we featured this in the exhibition that we did in Ballenstadt earlier this year. Basically, what happened was he was an art student. He had a flat with a roommate. His roommate had some, for lack of a better term, very peripheral political affiliations. And as the story goes, my grandfather spent the night at his girlfriend's house, and he came home in the morning and his roommate's throat was cut. Oh. And this is when a lot of this political upheaval was happening in Hamburg. And so 2 weeks later, he was on a boat to America. And what's interesting about this upheaval going on in Hamburg at the time, October of 23, was when they had the communist uprising in Hamburg. And that was actually the incident that gave Hitler a lot of opportunity to gain power, because it was driven by fear of what had happened in October in Hamburg. And so he came to Chicago.
Okay. I think it's important to get all of that history together as we move the story from Hamburg to Chicago, just to get a sense of what Chicago was like.
Yes.
And maybe I'll just remind my audience now, if you've listened to the German Chicago episodes, you'll know that the First World War basically was the beginning of the end of any outward show of German culture or Germanic culture in the United States and in Chicago. And that happened for a number of reasons. Obviously, the war was one major reason. And there are some also very strict government laws restricting, for example, German language newspapers, of which there were many in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And one thing they did is they insisted that every story be in every day's newspaper be translated and posted in the post office to a government office before it appeared the next day. And of course, that's impossible. You cannot be translating everything every day and posting it before you're even printing and writing the stories. So coming to Chicago at that time from Germany was not during a time of mass Germanic migration to Chicago. I think the second important point to mention is that 1923 is right between the two important immigration acts of 1921 and 1924, which we remember from previous episodes. These immigration acts primarily excluded Eastern Europeans and then Jews. So presumably your grandfather did not fall afoul of these quotas because he seemed to be able to immigrate quite easily. Did you ever get a sense of how his actual voyage and immigration went? Obviously, he didn't have much trouble.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. In doing the research for the Ballenstadt exhibition, I was able to find quite a bit. And so he had come on a ship called the Thuringia, which was a German ship out of Hamburg. And it was he traveled third class. And we have pictures of him that are very iconic as those pictures of people crossing over with his cap and all the rest at the age of 23. And I was able to find the Ellis Island records for his arrival, which was very interesting because they've scanned the manifests. So you can actually see like the pencil marks of the official sitting in front of him, checking off to make sure he had his ticket where he was going to go and this and that and everything. But there was a mystery that they would talk about a sponsor. And so there was an address for a sponsor that was up on 97th Street around First Avenue in New York. And so that is actually a very German neighborhood. And I don't have any knowledge or evidence of who that person might have been. Or maybe there were agencies that would help or a friend of a family or who knows what, but there was someone that actually vouched for him to help him get into the country. He had actually gone to Chicago because his sister had come the year before. So his sister in the village of Pottensen fell in love with a visiting minister at the church. But there was a problem. The minister, who they fell in love and got married in Pottensen, was ethnically Jewish. And so they figured out pretty quickly that they needed to get out of there. And so that's why they came to America in 1922. And they actually settled in South Dakota, but my grandpa came to Chicago at that time. And I know that he loved Chicago very much. He originally started, he was working for a photography studio in what eventually became his studio. So the building. So the building is at 6200 Clark Street in Rogers Park in Chicago, right near Clark and Granville. And that's where the original Bunny Graf studio was, the Heinzen studio, I should say. So he started out as an apprentice. He lived in the back at night. You know, he really didn't have a place to live. And he did that for several years. And then he had borrowed money from his sister to buy the studio. And then he eventually bought the building. And that's where he lived until 1957, to where he eventually moved to where I knew him as a child. He would talk about Chicago in those early days. And he definitely was embraced by the community. I mean, that Rogers Park area had a lot of Germans. He was a member of the Germania Club in Chicago. Somebody found a old board that would be up on the wall of the membership from the 20s, and his name is on it. And we actually only recently acquired it. And when he married my grandma, who had been from, she was German from Austria-Hungary, and her mother ended up living with them because in Chicago, you know, these buildings that they have are for multi-generational families. So that building on Clark Street had the studio on the first floor, their apartment on the second floor, and then my great-grandmother lived on the top floor. So they spoke German with her, but I remember my grandma always saying, well, if we didn't learn English, we wouldn't survive. And so they learned English and assimilated and everything. My grandparents married in 1930, and what had happened by that point was obviously they were in the full throes of the Depression. And so people could not afford a studio photographer. In fact, many of his clients in those early years were gangsters, believe it or not, because they were the ones that could afford a studio photographer. And so what he eventually did was he started focusing on photographing children. And very interestingly, because Chicago being an immigrant community, you couldn't pick up the phone and call the grandparents in Hungary and say, the kids are okay. You would send a picture postcard. That's actually how my grandfather met my grandmother, is that she came in to take pictures to send home to the relatives in Austria-Hungary. And so that was his business. It was very much, you know, dealing with all these interesting figures and all the rest. And he would tell me the stories of, you know, where he was when they had the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and all those things and all the parts of Chicago. And he was a fixture at the Green Mill. He would go there with my grandma and slip the money through the door during the Depression and, you know, Prohibition and everything. It was really, really interesting and exciting time. I wish I could go visit him, in all honesty.
It was an interesting time. It's also interesting to remember that the Germanic, and we've been using the terms Germanic communities in Chicago because it encompassed people from Austro-Hungary, from Poland, the German-speaking parts of Poland and the Czech Republic and all of this. and they did all come together. World War One, as you noted, and as your grandparents realized pretty quickly, although there was a German-speaking neighborhood in Chicago, it became less and less likely for them to want to speak German outside of their home or outside of the neighborhood, just because of the feelings about the war just made it uncomfortable for them. And so we look at this period as the sort of the end, the decline of Germanic Chicago, and it really ended then in World War II.
Yeah, another place that he mentioned in Chicago, I just want to mention, is the Brauhaus. So the Brauhaus in Lincoln Square, I know the restaurant's gone now, but that empty lot in the middle of the block, I don't know if you know this, was the original restaurant, and that burned to the ground and became an empty lot. So the restaurant moved to the property they owned across the street, which was their wedding hall, and that became the restaurant that people know. And of course, today the bar from the Brauhaus is in the Donkhaus a few blocks away.
Okay, so we've learned a little bit about your father's story, and we'll learn a little bit more about it as we continue. But why don't you just talk a little bit about how you found yourself more and more interested in your family history?
Yeah, thank you. Well, what I'm really lucky about with my family is that we have a lot of photographs, being a photographer. So I've grown up around these photographs. As I said, my grandfather died when I was 13. And he had, after, in 1957, he left the studio and bought a house in Saugnash, which is on the northwest side of the city. And that's where I grew up, just a few blocks away from him. And so, you know, like I said, I would go spend a lot of time with him. I'd hear stories and things. But in particular, he had this album from World War One with his pictures. And his pictures included many things. Like I said, the Richthofen, there's pictures of Kaiser Wilhelm that he took. There's all these interesting things. And I've always loved history. So in my life, I had gone to film school and became a filmmaker and whatnot. And so as we approached the centennial anniversary window, there was a symposium held at the World War One Kansas City Museum in 2014. And I attended this symposium, and it was people from all around the world, Germany, everywhere that came. I was one of the few people that wasn't associated with an institution. And basically, they came together to discuss, how are we going to approach this 100-year anniversary of this horrible conflict that touched every corner of the world? And it was great for me, because the universal message was, we want to tell the individual stories. We want to hear about these men, who they were. That's what we need to preserve, not the battles or the places, but who these men were. And I thought that was so wonderful. And so that was the spark of me looking to then try to find this connection with my grandfather's war experience. And so I had been traveling to Europe quite a bit for work. I'm involved with a film festival in Estonia, in the Baltic. And so in November of 2015, I decided to go to France to try to find where some of the pictures were taken. And I had my 14-year-old son at the time, and we went. And our plan was to fly to Frankfurt, go up through Belgium, and down to Paris. And I had never been to France before. I had not been to any of these battlefields before. But there was a problem. We got to Frankfurt 3 days after the terrible terror attack in November of 2015. In Paris at the Bataclan. That's where they were shooting the whole town up, and several, many, many people died. And so in the immediate aftermath of that horrible incident, there was this great panic across that part of Europe. And they thought a lot of the bad guys were in Belgium. So Belgium was basically shut down. You couldn't get a hotel. You couldn't get a restaurant. The borders were closed. It was a big mess. And so we had to pivot. So what we ended up doing is we ended up going through Luxembourg and then went across the top of France. And it was because of the top of France, we ended up in this town called Le Cateau. And Le Cateau it's a county seat, but it's not that very big of a town. There's no hotel. There's no McDonald's. It's a very small place. And we ended up in this square, and we were really not getting out of the car much, because there really wasn't much fighting in this part of Europe. And so, but this particular square opened up to this building, and I liked the town hall, the architecture. And so I got out to take a picture. And after I took the picture, I said, oh, my God, I've seen this before. And then I looked, and it was almost exactly the picture my grandfather had taken in 1917. And that was the catalyzing incident that unraveled everything I've now found out about his war experience.
And that was a photo of Kaiser Wilhelm.
So what happened was, once we found this town, one of the major buildings featured in these photographs, because I have these parades of soldiers, they're really amazing pictures. And all the assets I have are 4x5 content prints of glass plates. So as photographs of the era, they're immensely high quality, museum-grade quality, even unrestored. And so once I had this town, and it was very funny because my son and I got there, and we're like, oh my God, we found all this, but we don't speak French, right? So what do we do? And so this building that in 1917 was the Archdiocese is actually the National Museum for Matisse today. Matisse is from this village, and since the mid-50s, it's been a world-class museum, and they have special trains on Paris to bring people up on weekends, but that's about it. So I decided to go in and ask for the head librarian, hoping they would speak English, and they did. And it was very funny because she picks up the phone, she calls somebody, then she calls her husband comes, he doesn't speak French, he runs us down the street, knocks on a big door, the door opens up, and the old man says, come in, come in, and it's the mayor of the village, and he's a lawyer, and he speaks English. And people started coming from the village, like the archbishop and all these people started coming, and they were feeding us sandwiches and they were looking at the pictures. And what I came to find out was that it was very well known the Kaiser had visited this village during World War I. But all the photographs that have existed about it were mislabeled. So nobody thought there were any pictures of this town with the Kaiser, but I proved that there were. And the Kaiser was in this town as part of a special meeting held in the midst of a battle, the Battle of Cambrai, in November of 1917, which was the first tank battle in history. And so what had happened was the Germans, who had captured this tank, which the British invented, and they brought it behind the lines so all the generals could come and see it, and then the Kaiser came to see it. And once they studied it, they were able to counterattack and destroy all the tanks. And so my grandfather was there at this meeting. He was probably there with his aerodrome commander. He had photographed quite a bit of it. And then in the immediate aftermath, they sent photographers into the battlefield once they had pushed the British back to document all these tanks because they wanted to study them. And so in my journey, I met with different historians and they would see my photographs and they'd say, oh, I know that tank. I know that tank because those wrecks sat there till the mid 20s. They were huge. But they said, I've never seen this photo before. And many of my photos still have dead bodies in them. So this is as the battle is happening. And the battle ended because it snowed. So I can date these photos in a 4-day window because the day of the counterattack and the day of the snow, and none of my photos have snow. So it's really exciting, not being a professional researcher, how I've been able to find and make this connection to my grandfather's war experience.
That's fascinating. And personally for you, what kind of drove this?
Like I said, I'm a huge fan of history. I mean, my grandfather was nobody important. He was a private. He hated the war. You know, he wasn't highly decorated. It was nothing like that. He was a 17-year-old kid. But this was this crazy adventure that he lived through. And, you know, when he talked to me about the photographs when I was a child, you know, there were emotions that came out. And actually, when they made the second version of All Quiet on the Western Front, which was a TV movie with Ernest Borgnine and John Boy from the Waltons, it was like Platoon for him. He had PTSD and it really came out. And it was really interesting hearing that raw emotion coming out of this man that I knew and I loved. And I wanted to connect with that. I really wanted to try to find peace for him, which is really what eventually brought me to the focus of my documentary.
Good. And I want to talk about that documentary next. But before we do that, I just had a question, a personal question about if you know anything about how your grandfather reacted to the Second World War, being a German immigrant in Chicago.
Yeah. So in the 20s and 30s, he had been exhibitioning his art, his photographic art, portrait art around the world. He had been featured in salons in Paris, Japan, all over the world. And when World War II came, it was hard in Chicago owning a German business. And what had happened by that point, he had invented the bunny graph camera. So the bunny graph camera was something that he used to specialize in photographing children. He patented this giant rabbit that went over the camera and the lens came out of the stomach and the baby always looked at a rabbit. And it was an institution in Chicago from the 1920s till 1971 when he retired. And so now it's December 7th, 1941. And so now there's all this paranoia, the war's coming and everything else. They're jumping in against the Germans. And so he had decided he was going to change the name of the studio from the Heinzen Studio to the Bunny Graph Studio. And it's interesting, I found pictures of streetcars because there used to be a streetcar in Clark Street. That's why it's such a wide street. And there are pictures of his building with the Heinzen Studio on the background. So we know that's what's the name of it. And Marshall Fields had hired him right after the Pearl Harbor attack to come down to State Street, and he set up a studio in the basement, and they took pictures of the little kids for the soldiers that were going to go overseas. So actually the war for him proved to be a booming business. And by 1950, he had 5-6 studios in Chicago because people were taking pictures to send home, send to the soldiers overseas. And then after the war, the baby boom, they would have all these pictures. And so Marshall Fields was a big part of that on State Street to help him build the business. And actually he had a photographer that was Japanese American. So here's this German with this Japanese photographer. It was very, very stressful. And I don't believe that his photographer, whose name was Ken, he was very Americanized. I do not believe he had to go to an internment camp, if I remember correctly. But I know a lot of people in Chicago did.
Interesting. Okay, I really like this idea that you're pursuing, which is so important, of trying to get to know the people that we see in these old photos and in these old war photos. We forget your grandfather was 16, which is very young to be seeing all of this death and destruction.
Yes.
And then we see all of these other pictures. And even to this day, you see a photo in the news from Ukraine or wherever, and you just kind of wonder, who are these people? And I think it's so valuable that you're really focusing on this. So let's move into discussing your documentary, which is a really, really sort of empathic look at the tragedy of war, but also how potentially, if we're not being so cynical, after wars, there can be healing. So why don't you tell us about your great POW documentary?
Yeah, so it's really interesting in that, like I said, I've spent a lot of time on the battlefields in France, because what I was doing was I was taking his aerial photographs and matching them with Google Earth and then going to the sites. So between 2015 and 2018, I went to France 12 times. So I was there a lot. I spent more time in the mud in France than my grandfather did. And when you go there and you're alone in these solemn places, you have these moments that are just unbelievable. You walk in these fields today, these cleared battlefields, but you still find live ordnance that still bubble up. They call them the iron harvest that kills farmers to this day, where they hook a live shell from 100 years ago and it kills them. I found human remains. I found a leg bone once. It completely traumatized me. I was there by myself in the rain, in the mud. And here's this leg bone. And I went to a British cemetery and I buried it. And it was just, you hit these things. The men really speak to you when you're really there touching the soil where so many men died. And so it was November of 2017. And I had really found where a lot of the stuff was. And I had been asked to present at the commemoration, 100th commemoration of this tank battle, in November of 2017. And I was the only person invited to speak from the German perspective. It was a huge British event because this was such a big British value and the whole thing. And so I had already decided I wanted to do a documentary, but I was struggling as to what the purpose would be. And I met with a wonderful man who's just recently passed away, Mitchell Block, who's an Academy Award nominated documentary filmmaker, head of documentary at USC. And I met with him and I showed him everything I had, all the pictures where I found the locations. And he said, you don't have any documentary at all. And it made me laugh because I knew I was struggling. He said, you don't have a documentary. Do documentaries about living people. Never do them about dead people. And I thought that was fascinating. So now the next week I was in France. I had done my presentation. It was very well received. And I was invited to do a personal tour of descendants, British descendants, to walk this tank battlefield 100 years to the minute that it actually happened. And on that tour, I met a woman. She came up and she grabbed my arm and she said, I want to talk to you. And as we're walking the battlefield, she told me about her grandfather. And her grandfather was a highly decorated British officer in this battle. And she showed me right where his tank had been destroyed. And he was able to get out and everybody in his tank died. And he lived his life with survivor guilt. And she did not know her grandfather, but she felt with the 100th anniversary, she wanted to come to the battlefield and try to heal for her grandfather. And she said to me, I've been here, I've seen everything, and it wasn't until I heard your talk that I knew you were the one to heal my grandfather. And she stopped walking, hugged me, and cried like a baby. And I said, there's my documentary. And so my documentary is focused on, well, I have two. There's two photographs that I have that are of prisoners of war captured in this tank battle. Unlike most battles of the First World War, this tank battle moved very quickly, because the tanks were able to surpass the trenches. On the first day of the attack, they actually captured 9,000 Germans. That never happened in World War I. So now I have these two pictures of POWs that were captured in the Battle of Cambrai, November of 1917.
These are British soldiers that were captured.
Well, so I have two photographs. I have a group of British prisoners, 30 British prisoners, but I also have a group of 9 American prisoners.
Okay.
And these are the very first Americans to ever face the Germans in World War I. And they were railroad engineers from New York City. And so this engineering unit, which is very highly decorated, was assigned to the British. And when the British attacked with these tanks, they damaged these railroad tracks. And so what happened was they were working on the tracks. When the Germans counterattacked, they literally came over the hill and they threw down their shovels, picked up rifles, and engaged the Germans. A third were killed, a third were captured, and a third got away. And I have the photograph that has been mostly lost to history of the 9 Americans that were captured. And I have their Red Cross records. And so I know they survived the war. I know they came home. And so I am working to meet their families today, to present the photograph to them, and then to find out who these men were. Who were they? And what were they all about? And what was their war experience like? And really to keep them alive by bringing back their story. And so in the case of the British photograph, what happened was in November of 2018, I decided I was going to be in London for the anniversary, not Paris. And so I was working with a writer who was helping me with research in a British charity. And we actually found one of the people in the British photo, a man by the name of Captain Thomas Box from Liverpool. And we went to Liverpool and we met his granddaughter. And she did not know her grandfather. He had died in the 1940s, but we brought him back to life for her. And that was just such a wonderful experience. We got on the national news and in all of the papers on the anniversary of World War I. And it was just this great experience seeing this idea, you know, in the spirit of Mandela about defining peace through forgiveness. Like, what better way to give remembrance to this lost generation of men on all sides and make it a message of peace for the future? Wouldn't it be great for these men to know that their great-grandchildren are meeting in peace? And so that's the purpose of the documentary, to talk about this photograph that my grandfather took to meet these people, but then to dig deeper as to what it means about keeping these people alive.
I love the comment, peace through forgiveness, and I think that's a wonderful way of closing up our talk today about Walter Heinzen and his story, and you, John, and your story, and all the great work you're doing connecting these ancestors to their great-grandparents or grandparents and trying to learn a little bit more about the war and also about healing after the war.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.